Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Catpol USA Talks, and this week I'm going to be looking at the issue of abortion and the Supreme Court. We're calling this one the Supreme Court, Final Protector of Women's Rights. With the possibility that the Supreme Court may decide to hear the HB2 Texas bill about defunding of abortion, or possibly the case in Missouri, abortion is once again looking set to be decided at the Supreme Court. And the question to consider here is why? Why is it the Supreme Court, and how has the Supreme Court justified its stance on abortion over the years? So we're going to be looking at the history and development of the issue of abortion and how it relates to the Supreme Court. To begin with, we're going to go back to a Supreme Court justice appointed by Eisenhower called William Brennan. Now, he was a Supreme Court justice who was appointed in the mid-50s, and he would serve on into the 1990s. His important legacy was in coming up with a judicial theory that declared an implicit right to privacy. This was mainly centred on the declaration of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. But Brennan argued, along with Douglas, another Supreme Court justice, that this right was implicit in other parts of the Constitution, in various of the other rights. The key phrase here is that it was an implicit right to privacy. It is not clearly stated in the Constitution. So we have a good example here of the living Constitution. Brennan believed that all citizens had a right to privacy in their own homes, protected by the Constitution. But that is clearly a judicial theory and evidence of Brennan's judicial activism. It was Brennan's argument for the implicit right to privacy that paved the way for an expansion of judicial power and activism, and led to, eventually, the Scalia backlash of originalism. Although Brennan didn't come up with the theory on his own, he did work closely with Justice Douglas on that, and to a degree with Hugo Black as well, both FDR appointments to the Supreme Court. Now, Brennan and Douglas worked together to find a right to privacy in the Bill of Rights. The justification mainly came from the First Amendment, which they argued was not just about political association, but social, legal and economic association as well, and people had a right to privacy in their dealings with other people. They looked at the Third Amendment, and they said the prohibition of quartering soldiers was clearly stated as being in private homes. Therefore, what went on in the home was private, and there was a right to privacy. The Fifth Amendment provided a wall of privacy with an individual being questioned by the government, the right not to accuse yourself, the famous right to silence. And in the Ninth Amendment, where rights are not enumerated by the Constitution, they would be retained by the people. Therefore, privacy is not enumerated in the Constitution, and it is the right of the people to hold privacy. That's their argument, and obviously based on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th. To put it mildly, this was seen as an elastic bit of judicial reasoning, stretching the interpretations of the Constitution to fit with their own aims. The first time that the issue of a right to privacy came through in a Supreme Court ruling was in the case of Griswold versus Connecticut in the 1960s. Now, Connecticut still had on its statute books an 1879 law that made the use of contraception to prevent conception a crime. Now, mostly this was one of those archaic laws, like the rule in law that you can't shoot a Welsh, that it is allowed to shoot a Welshman with a bow and arrow, in the city of York. It's mostly an ignored rule, and people in the 1960s were buying contraception in Connecticut without much of a problem. But the interest group Planned Parenthood wanted it removed, and so they thought about challenging the rule. In 1961, a lady called Estelle Griswold was arrested and fined $100 for buying contraception in Connecticut. In engineering her arrest and her appeal to the Supreme Court, she hoped to get the law overturned. So again, nice example of how pressure groups use the Supreme Court to achieve their means. The 1960s court was certainly the most liberal in history, led by Chief Justice Earl Warren. None of the justices liked the Connecticut statute, but were unsure if there really was a constitutional basis to overturn it. Initially, Douglas tried to argue the First Amendment about freedom of speech and political association, but it was seen as a weak judicial argument. Along with Brennan, then, Douglas developed the theory of a constitutional right to privacy and argued that on this basis, it was unconstitutional to prevent a married couple from buying contraception. This ruling itself didn't really cause much controversy at the time, but the ramifications of the ruling would be huge. We then move forward to Roe versus Wade in 1973. By the 1970s, there was a split across the USA. Some states allowed abortion, others did not, and some allowed it in exceptional cases, very exceptional cases, and some allowed it in most cases. So there was a bit of a mixture across the USA with regards to whether a person could get an abortion. A woman called Norma McCorvey was a Texan woman who became pregnant with her third child, which she could not afford to keep or raise. Norma McCorvey therefore sought an abortion and started off by claiming that she had been raped, which was not true, but she did that because Texas law did allow an abortion in the case of rape. But without police documentation of the rape, she was not allowed to go and get an abortion. She therefore tried to go to an illegal abortion clinic, but the police had closed this one down because it was illegal. Under the help of a local Planned Parenthood association, she appealed to the district court and eventually to the Supreme Court. The case was so controversial that she filed the suit under the name Jane Roe to avoid personal attacks. As it happened, because the legal process takes so long, she gave birth before the case was heard. So in essence, it was a moot point for Norma McCorvey, but Planned Parenthood kept the case going to establish the principle. Now, the decision would become, or in Roe versus Wade, would become one of the most controversial decisions in Supreme Court history. An ironically conservative-appointed justice, Harry Blackmun, who'd been appointed by Richard Nixon, wrote the opinion of the court, relying heavily on the ruling in Griswold to state that a woman had a freedom of personal choice in matters of marriage and family life. So you can see how Supreme Court justices base their decisions on precedent, on previous cases. The decision was a 7-2 ruling, so again, not a controversial 5-4 split as we perhaps come used to. And Republican appointees Blackmun, Berger, Brennan and Powell, and Stewart, all joined by the Democratic appointees of Marshall and Douglas, were in the 7 majority. So it wasn't a partisan court. You know, 5 Republicans and 2 Democrat appointments sided with the ruling and decided it was a constitutional right, while the Republican appointment, William Rehnquist, and the Democrat appointment, White, both dissented on constitutional grounds. And that's key. They dissented on constitutional grounds that the right to privacy was not clearly enumerated in the Constitution and therefore not on moral grounds. The decision was criticised by many legal scholars on constitutional and legal grounds, and it sparked the moral conservative movement into life, an organisation with the single goal of changing the court to overturn Roe. So this politically has been massively significant in energising the Christian right as they sought to get Roe overturned. As it happened, most Americans, then and now, felt a woman should have the right to choose, but those against have a lot more money and much bigger voices. So again, we can see how a minority tries to shape the Supreme Court to achieve its own goals. So the Christian right set about trying to influence the Republican Party in order to influence the changing of the Supreme Court in order to overturn Roe versus Wade. Now, this is obviously a very long-term goal, but it looks like they may finally have achieved what they've been looking for. The Christian right mobilised after 1973 to get rid of Roe, and they ended up settling on Ronald Reagan and giving them their support. And it was the Christian right that really pushed Ronald Reagan into the White House in 1980. Under Reagan, and then Bush Sr., the Republicans were able to add 5 new justices, replacing 5 of the voters in Roe. Douglas had already been replaced by Stevens in 1975, but he had been a great disappointment to conservatives because he ended up shifting further and further to the left. So the appointments by Reagan and Bush, supported by the religious right, were Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, Anthony Kennedy, Clarence Thomas and David Souter. And they'd all come in to replace Stuart, Berger, Powell, Marshall and Brennan. So on paper, you'd look at this and say a set of liberal justices had been replaced by a set of conservative justices. And therefore, you would have expected by the late 1990s, by the early 1990s, that the Supreme Court would have been willing to overturn the Roe decision. Of course, the Supreme Court can't be activist and they can't just rush into it. They have to wait for a case to be heard. In this case, the case that finally came through was that of Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Governor Robert P. Casey, famously now known as Casey versus Planned Parenthood, or depending on which part of the case you're looking at, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Since Roe, states with anti-abortion majorities had tried different ways to pass restrictive laws that the Supreme Court would approve of. So, although they can't ban a woman from having a constitution, they tried to put in restrictions that would make it difficult or dissuade women from wanting an abortion. In 1989, the state of Pennsylvania passed one of the most restrictive laws in America. Remember, Pennsylvania has a huge Catholic population and the Catholic Church was advocating anti-abortion stances. The law in Pennsylvania forced women who wanted an abortion to wait 24 hours after contacting a clinic. It also mandated that a woman be given a lecture about fetal development and alternatives to abortion. Minors, that would be those under 18, seeking an abortion would have to have permission from a parent or a judge. A married woman would have to inform their husband of their plans. Of course, Planned Parenthood challenged this law that had been signed in to law by Governor Casey, and it would go up to the Third Circuit, which heard cases originating in Pennsylvania. Now, three judges on the Third Circuit heard the case in October 1991. The court upheld most of the law, so most of the law was absolutely fine. But a 2-1 majority declared the rule on married women having to inform their husbands was not constitutional and therefore rejected it. The third judge, a certain Samuel Alito, would have kept that requirement, basically saying that any restrictions passed on abortion were acceptable. The most interesting point at this stage is the fact that the Third Circuit paid no attention at all to the ruling of Roe versus Wade. They didn't look at the right as argued by the Supreme Court. They basically ignored it, which the Court of Appeals should not be doing. But it was such a controversial decision that they decided not to use that as the basis of their decisions. So again, there was a lack of clear coherence between the different districts and different circuits in America over how to enforce the Supreme Court's ruling. And that emphasises the weakness of the Supreme Court. They can only issue the decisions, they can't then enforce them later on. Now, obviously with this decision, it got appealed up to the Supreme Court. Now, Planned Parenthood appealed the decision to the Supreme Court, and it was granted cert, so four justices agreed to hear it, in 1992. And from a conservative point of view, everything looked good. With the new appointments replacing the original majority, it was seen that the Roe versus Wade would be overturned and states would go back to deciding whether or not a woman could have an abortion and in what circumstances. Planned Parenthood chose a lawyer called Catherine Colbert as their representative. That's Catherine and Colbert with K's. Colbert came up with a novel strategy in terms of arguing the case in front of the Supreme Court. And she basically said, let's just go for broke. Let's go for a big activist decision. And so what she argued was that either the Supreme Court should uphold all the provisions of the Pennsylvania law and thereby completely overturn Roe, or it should reject all the provisions and therefore confirm Roe. And in terms of legal strategy, that was a stroke of absolute genius. Now, in conference, there was a muddled decision going on. So when, after hearing the oral arguments, the justice sat around the big table and it was a bit of a confused mess. Seven justices, Rehnquist, White, O'Connor, Scalia, Kennedy, Souter and Thomas, so the conservative ones you'd assume, They wanted to uphold most of the provisions in the Pennsylvania law. Only John Paul Stevens and Harry Blackmun, who wrote the original decision, wanted to strike it all down. This should have been a clear majority. This should be a 7-2 majority upholding most of the provisions in the Pennsylvania law. But that's not what Colbert had argued. And there were tensions in this majority. Now, even after conference, when they've had their vote, it may be a 7-2 majority, but nothing is final until the Supreme Court reads its decision from the bench. Rehnquist, White, Scalia and Thomas were all on record as wanting to overturn Roe completely. So we had the four there. O'Connor, Kennedy and Souter, though, were not quite ready to go that far. So the key thing here was going to be how the final decision was going to be written. Would it overturn the whole of Roe, or would it maintain Roe? And the majority split here. Crucially, the Conservatives, who wanted to get rid of it, only had four. And the most important rule on the Supreme Court is that five beats four. Rehnquist assigned himself this important decision with the intention of allowing the states almost a free hand in regulating abortion, effectively ending the constitutional right to have an abortion, so states could basically ban abortion in their own state, going back to the situation pre-1973. Now, this is going away, and people knew what Rehnquist was likely to be writing and producing. Something very rare then happened, though. David Souter paid a visit to one of his colleagues. It's a rare thing. Justices tend to work alone in their offices. They don't actually socialise in their offices and go and have a chat with each other. But sometimes they will go round and sometimes they will have a chat. And when David Souter went to chat with Sandra Day O'Connor, they agreed that they could not stand all the provisions. Okay, they could not get rid of all the provisions and they could not maintain them all. O'Connor herself was particularly furious about Alito's ruling about spousal notification. But Rehnquist was actually writing to uphold that provision. And that's the key. O'Connor couldn't stand the decision to, or Alito's opinion, that a woman had to inform her husband. They both agreed, this is Souter and O'Connor, both agreed to uphold the essence of Roe and to strike down the spousal notification clause. So basically, they kind of ignored Colbert's argument and said, right, what we'll do is we'll uphold Roe and we'll strike down the idea that you have to inform your husband and therefore say Pennsylvania's restrictions weren't legal. Stevens and Blackmun would certainly join with them in that decision to defend Roe, but that was only four. So we've got four definitely against and four definitely in favour of upholding Roe. So the last one was to see Kennedy. On this occasion, the swing justice. So, as he does so often these days, Kennedy actually ended up deciding the abortion issue. Now, Kennedy was and is a hardcore Catholic. He was very much opposed to Roe on moral grounds and on constitutional grounds. However, the thing to remember with Kennedy is he has a massive ego. And he likes the idea of showing that judges are noble in what they do and that they are above personal political considerations. Somehow, Souter and O'Connor managed to persuade Kennedy to join with them to show how noble he was. So they managed to play on his ego and allow him to write parts of the decision. So O'Connor, Kennedy and Souter end up going off and writing their own decision or their own verdict, whilst Rehnquist is still busily away writing his version of it. Now, changes in voting like this are rare, but no vote is final, as I mentioned, until the opinion is actually read from the bench. Kennedy's switch was truly dramatic, and it was so shaky that actually O'Connor, Kennedy and Souter had to write their opinion in secret so as not to cause major disruption in the Supreme Court. It's all cloak and dagger stuff and very exciting. O'Connor ends up giving the final verdict. Okay, so the three, Kennedy, Souter and O'Connor, joined by Stevens and Blackmun, made a court majority. They got the five beats four. O'Connor's ruling, she wrote most of it, she delivered it for the court, rejected the trimester framework of Roe, which sort of had a sliding scale of when a woman could have an abortion. And instead, she replaced it with the concept of viability outside the womb. And the key phrase she wrote was the undue burden clause. Basically, she argued, no state or federal government had the right to place an undue burden, meaning any potential obstacle, on a woman attempting to get an abortion on an unviable fetus. So there's two sides there. If the fetus is not viable outside the womb, and a woman may seek an abortion, and further to that, a state cannot place an undue burden or obstacle in their path of getting an abortion. Essentially, although it did change the essence of the ruling, essentially the right to have an early term abortion was saved. Obviously, after proof that a fetus could be viable, then an abortion would be restricted. So strict limits were put in place, and that is why we get lots of pressure groups in America trying to show or prove that a fetus is viable. Scalia, unsurprisingly, was absolutely furious. He sees it as interpretive. It goes against his idea of originalism because, of course, the Supreme Fathers would have had nothing or no consideration of abortion in the Constitution. And Thomas equally was not very happy either. Though when is Clarence Thomas happy? And Alito on the Third Circuit was clearly rebuked. Okay, in her opinion, O'Connor specifically wrote a damning assessment of Alito's opinion from the Third Circuit. So, you know, we can see O'Connor was very much opposed to Alito's actions. And she was clear that a provision that required a married woman to inform her husband that she was having an abortion was an unconstitutional restriction on her individual rights and liberty. So she put Alito firmly in his place in her decision. Now, after this, and after the perceived failure of the right's long-held campaign to change the court, with Kennedy, Souter and O'Connor switching their votes and defending Roe, the right started to get a bit desperate. Obviously, the Christian right was furious about the ruling in Casey, and they felt that they'd been betrayed, and the whole Republican cause had been betrayed. And, of course, that's an issue with the politicisation of the judiciary. It's supposed to be neutral and non-party political. But since Roe, it has become increasingly political. And justices like Kennedy, O'Connor and Souter, and any justice appointed ever since, are being asked about their views on abortion, and it's becoming much more political in the appointment process. So interest groups since then have set about trying to undermine the law by promoting restrictions based on the viability clause, you know, trying to show that potentially a life could be viable with medical technology, or if there's any evidence at all of a heartbeat, that's what viability might mean, or if somewhere in the world at some point a baby has been born at a particularly early stage and has managed to survive, even if it's only for half an hour, then that is evidence of viability. So they've set up ways of trying to interpret viability to further their own means. There have also been plans to limit funding for abortion centres and placing undue restrictions on the businesses. And that has become the major issue of this moment. Can a state have a right to defund abortion clinics? And this was something that was passed in 2013 in Texas, but I'll come back to that a bit later on. But the right's basically been trying to find ways of undermining the ruling. Despite Colbert's victory by going for broke, the right would still look to undermine Roe a tiny piece at a time. And usually, if you want to be successful on the Supreme Court, you look at it and get little parts undermined. Little parts here, little parts there, until you can... till America's ready for the final decision. Now, this really came to a head with the issue of partial birth abortion. So rather than trying to overturn the rulings on all abortions, you looked at one very specific type of abortion to try and get the Supreme Court to say that those types of abortions could be abolished. So small steps to try and achieve a bigger goal. Now, partial birth abortions are very, very grim, and they certainly do not sound pleasant. Basically, the procedure is complex, but it involves the head and the removal of the brains from the fetus and the partial dismemberment of the fetus. These are very, very, very rare. Okay, they very rarely happen. They are late term usually as well, and they are only ever carried out because a woman's life is in grave and serious danger, and the only reason, or the only way she will have any chance of survival is by having the fetus removed, and the only way to do that in a safe way is by basically dismembering it before it's removed. Very rare, very unlikely. However, because it's such a grim and unpleasant sounding experience, by publicising the details of partial birth abortions, the right helped to outrage many Americans and help, and it gave them a sort of flag to wave about how cruel and terrible abortions were. And the right started pouncing on this and led to calls and encouraged calls to abolish the practice of partial birth abortions. Now, there's a doctor called Leroy H. Carhart, and he was one of the few doctors willing to admit publicly that he performed partial birth abortions. It was so controversial that another doctor, George Tiller, was actually murdered by an anti-abortion terrorist in 2009 because he carried out partial birth abortions. And there were lots of serious attacks on doctors that carried out abortions generally, but specifically the partial birth ones. On two occasions, Carhart led a legal appeal against laws banning partial birth abortions. One in 2000, one in 2006. Now, the key thing there is to remember what changed between those two dates. Hopefully you've remembered that, but if not, we will come to that in a second. Now, the first case was Stenberg versus Carhart. In this case, the Supreme Court, rejected a Nebraska state law that banned partial birth abortions. It was a split decision, 5-4, and the swing justice on this occasion was O'Connor. Kennedy moved with the Conservatives, but O'Connor decided it. In the end, Breyer wrote the opinion, and he justified it on the grounds of the health of the mother, a woman's right to life, and that was the decision. In Gonzalez versus Carhart, when Bush, things had changed slightly. In 2005, Bush was re-elected and had a Republican Congress to back him. And his priority was to sign into law the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. So Congress was going to pass a law banning partial birth abortions. And I think it's quite clear what that law does. It was almost identical to the one that had been overturned in 2000. So, again, so much for checks and balances here. So the Supreme Court had said the Nebraska law was unconstitutional, and now Congress is passing basically the same law for the whole of America. The court heard the case on appeal in 2006. Only one change, major change, had occurred there. Okay, Roberts replaced Rehnquist, but the serious change was that O'Connor had been replaced by Alito. That's the very judge O'Connor had criticised in the Casey ruling earlier. The court ruled 5-4 to uphold the new law and effectively set the precedent that a mother's life was not the main concern in abortion cases. Now, the swing justice who decided this case was Kennedy, and he wrote the opinion for the court. This is quite a significant case. So the two Carhart rulings are both important ones to learn next, to learn about. Because what it does is it shows how Alito's replacement of O'Connor changed the direction and focus of the Supreme Court, having gone from basically saying partial birth abortions were constitutional because of a woman's right to life. In 2006, they say they aren't constitutional and implicitly argue that a woman's right to life is not a sacred idea in the Constitution. So what happens next? It's likely that over the course of this term, the Supreme Court will be forced to hear a case on Texas HB 2. This is the abortion law passed in 2013. It's the most prominent. There was one in Mississippi as well. But it's the law that will effectively lead to the closure of many abortion clinics in America. Now, a bit on the background with this. Basically, states like Texas have refused funding for hospitals that have abortion clinics, therefore forcing abortion clinics to be run as private businesses away from hospitals. And this is how a chain of abortion clinics, either Planned Parenthood centres or whole women's health centres, are created to provide the service for women. because of a case that happened in Pennsylvania a few years earlier, where basically a woman was going through an abortion and ended up dying of complications, the Texas state legislature passed this law in 2013 saying that all abortion clinics in the state of Texas had to have the same medical standards as a hospital. In order to get them up to standard, a huge amount of money would have to be spent, and the cost of getting an abortion would rise exponentially. Effectively, the abortion clinics across Texas would have to close. They reckon all but three would be closed. Now, Amy Miller, who's the founder of Whole Woman's Health, is suing the state of Texas on this law, and she's basically saying that by removing or by forcing this extra requirement on the abortion clinics and therefore forcing them to close, it will prevent a woman having easy access to gaining an abortion, that she will either have to travel miles and miles and miles across the state of Texas, which is vast, or perhaps have to go to another state. And her argument is, going back to the Casey ruling, that this is an undue burden on the mother. The state of Texas argue that they're not banning abortion, they're just trying to make it as safe as possible, so that if something goes wrong, as it did in Pennsylvania, a woman will be able to have the medical treatment to the same standard that she would in a hospital, and therefore her life would be safe. So both are arguing that they're acting in the interests of the woman's health, but they're disagreeing over what exactly that means. It's not clear whether or not this decision will be granted cert yet, but there is a clear difference between the Fifth Circuit, which is where this is being held, covering Texas and Louisiana, and a number of other circuits in the northern states, which have said that basically you can't have these sorts of restrictions. They are an undue burden. So when there is a split like this between the different appeals courts, it's likely the Supreme Court will hear it. And if they determine that it is constitutional, that could have consequences across America. It could effectively end the right to an abortion, just simply because other states will copy Texas. Mississippi's already done this, and they will basically put requirements that are so prohibitive that the regular abortion clinics will not be able to continue. And therefore, although the states haven't actually banned abortion in their states, they've effectively made it impossible. But the key argument will be on that undue burden clause. Who's going to decide it? Almost certainly Kennedy. And he's got a checkered history on this. We know personally he's against it. The question is, will his ego be massaged? Will he side with the liberal quartet, as he did in the Casey decision? Or will he side with the conservative quartet, as he did in Gonzales? And that's an important case to be aware of coming to the Supreme Court and its implications. So, to draw this to a conclusion, what does the issue of abortion tell us about the Supreme Court in America? Well, one, where states and Congress are perhaps unwilling to pass a law or deal with a law, the Supreme Court will be targeted by pressure groups to achieve their aims. And that's because of its power of judicial review. Minorities, and it's odd to think of women as a minority, but we're classing them as a minority or an underrepresented group in American politics. If they are not being represented well by Congress or in their state legislatures, we'll use the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court is important at protecting what we'll call here minority rights. So therefore providing the rule of law and upholding individual rights and liberties. The third is how the Supreme Court justices use precedent to justify decisions in a number of cases. Obviously, Roe v. Wade was based on Giswold. Planned Parenthood used Casey as a justification, used Roe as a justification, and in the initial Carhart ruling, Casey was used in the idea of the undue burden. What it also tells us, or demonstrates quite clearly, is the dramatic shift of the Supreme Court by Alito replacing O'Connor. So Alito's replacement of O'Connor and the comparison of the two Carhart cases shows how significant that change was, and shows that George W. Bush was able to finally make the court more conservative, because Alito has acted exactly as he was expected to. He's very conservative on abortion and has struck that down, whereas O'Connor was in favour of it. So a clear shift on the Supreme Court. It also tells us something about politics in America in general. Why has the Supreme Court nomination process become so political? Because of the issue of abortion more than anything else. The right want to make sure they get conservative judges who will strike it down, and the left want to make sure they get liberal judges who will uphold abortion. And therefore, Supreme Court nominees will be tested. Harriet Myers had to withdraw her nomination because there wasn't enough proof for the hard right that she was going to be conservative enough on abortion. They didn't want another O'Connor who might prove to be quite liberal, or even worse, a John Paul Stevens or David Souter. In the end, although he was well qualified and a capable judge, Bush had to pick Alito, who had very clear rulings, as in the Casey one, of being opposed in all circumstances to abortion. And of course, Alito's nomination was massively controversial, not because of his ability as a judge, but because of his history on abortion and abortion rulings, and because the Democrats on the left were, by and large, very opposed to him. So we get this whole politicisation of the whole nomination process. And there are other factors as well, but it's mainly due to abortion. And all of this is why abortion is such an important issue in American politics. The final thought is the position of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, she is obviously a liberal justice, and she has defended on every occasion the right of a woman to have an abortion. But she is critical of the original Roe decision. And it's a useful one on the role of judicial activism versus restraint. Ginsburg, who made a name by taking small steps on promoting gender equality, has criticised Roe versus Wade for being far too activist, far too big a ruling, and trying to change too much all at once. She argued that it would have been better in Roe versus Wade if they had simply said that the Texas law was far too restrictive, and should have said there are this one in this one instance a woman could have the right to an abortion. And then there might have been another case and another case, and they could have slowly chipped away at the restrictions in order to establish a woman's right to an abortion. By going for such a big activist ruling, it inspired and sparked the right into political activism in America, which has had a knock-on effect to the Republican Party. And it's meant that for the last 30, 40 years, the right have been trying to chip slowly away at Roe versus Wade. So instead of abortion restrictions being chipped away at, it's been the right to have an abortion that's being chipped away at. And that's affected the political landscape in America. So we can see the role of the Supreme Court in American politics, why it's so controversial, and a number of key decisions that give us lots of illustrative examples about the way the Supreme Court works, which is why it's important to know about the issue of abortion and particularly its impact on the Supreme Court. Now, I hope you got a lot out of this. There will be a handout with more information on HB2. And I look forward to talking to you again in the third episode of the Cat Poll USA Talks. Thank you very much for listening.